I know I don't have to tell you this, but this episode is only for educational purposes. It is not nutrition or personalized medical advice. We want you to get the most from the episode, but to keep that in mind as well. And we really hope you enjoy it. Welcome to the Quiet the Diet podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Shapiro. I am an integrative functional registered dietitian in New York City who has helped over 1,000 clients reverse their anxiety, approach their weight lovingly, and heal their digestive issues. I help clients to access liberating self-awareness through humor, compassion, and nuance. I lost 100 pounds the wrong way so that you don't have to, you know, without all the physical and psychological damage that comes along with it. Whole body health requires so much more than just going on a restrictive diet. The Quiet the Diet podcast offers a holistic look at what it takes to be your most vibrant, healthy self. I want to help you quiet the diet so you can focus on all the other parts of your amazing health and life. Welcome to the pod. I can't wait to explore the magic of functional nutrition and medicine together. On today's episode, we are going to be sitting down with the incredible women behind Wise and Well, Maria Claps and Kristen Johnson, who are going to be talking to us about menopause. Kristen does this really incredible job of walking us through how our common kind of societal understanding of menopause has come to be and what we might need to challenge about that notion. The episode centers around hormone replacement therapy, which is a huge component of the education aspect and advocacy aspect of the work that Wise and Well does. Maria is an FDN practitioner and Kristen an NTP board certified and holistic nutritionist. And they are plain spoken friends and practitioners who share a passion for women's health, especially women's health at midlife. As both are themselves menopausal, they've refined the art and science of thriving as a midlife woman based on both clinical and personal experience. They combined individualized nutrition and lifestyle changes tailored to midlife women's needs with mindset coaching, lab testing, and hormone replacement therapy education to help women thrive so that they can stop or prevent their health from spinning out of control. On a personal note, Maria and Kristen are just so deeply passionate. They are fiery. They are compassionate. And it was just such a delight to have such a strong duo on the podcast. And it was just a really powerful conversation that I'm really eager for you to hear. If you are a woman going through menopause or considering your future as you go through menopause, I think this episode is truly a must listen. And it challenges so many of the notions that we have about hormone replacement therapy and so many notions about how we deserve to feel as we age, as we move through life. For that reason, I'm so excited to introduce you to these guests and to this episode. I can't wait to see you in there. I am joyously here with my friends, my colleagues, in many ways, role models too, Maria and Kristen of Wise and Well. I am so excited to have you both here today.
Thank you. We're super excited.
Yeah, thank you.
So funny because before we got on today, we were viciously laughing and screaming about all these things that are going on in the nutrition world. So what I love so much about both of you is that you take topics that are very controversial and I know you're very passionate about, but you still approach them deeply with science and with so much compassion. And the field that you're working in should not be controversial, but it is. And that's why I always find your approach so refreshing. And I know so many women find your approach so completely necessary and like different, which is weird. Can we talk first just about a little bit about what you both do and what your business does and how you help women?
Yeah. I would say we are primarily in the education business, really. There's a dearth of education when it comes to menopause. Well, maybe up until about three to five years ago, there was a dearth of education. Now there's, you know, every philosophy you want to choose from. But yeah, so to put it simply, I'll let Kristen expand on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for women, I think many of us come to working as practitioners in the health field simply because we have a personal experience that ends up sort of, you know, opening our eyes to maybe some things that are broken in the system and we want to change it, you know? And I think that's what Marie and I are trying to be a little bit, our change agents. But we find that the only way to do that, because there's so much inertia right now against women's health beyond, you know, maybe menstruation, fertility, pregnancy, and lactation, and that's it. And after that, women's health doesn't seem to matter all that much. And any woman over the age of 40 knows it matters a lot. And, you know, we're going to be spending maybe half our lives in a state of, you know, whether we call it the menopausal transition or postmenopause, but in a state of hormone depletion that has significant ramifications for women's health. And there's no education on this being taught to our doctors. There's no standard of care that addresses it. There's no training that helps people navigate this space. And so we're just trying to educate sort of where the holes are. And we take a lot of abuse for it because it's a bit disrupting to the status quo. And so if people want to call us disruptors, go ahead. We'll wear that badge with honor. So,
are you saying it's disruptive to believe that 50% of the population, how they feel should matter for half of their lives?
Yep.
That's weird.
And that's the funny thing is, you know, is it a cultural sort of paradigm that's created this situation, right? And that we rear the children and, you know, kind of see a sunset on our career and then, you know, just kind of go quietly, right? So is it that? And people want to argue that. They want to argue, is it a pathology? Is it because of, you know, the patriarchy? You know, they have all these kind of descriptors to explain what's going on. And then that leads them to decide whether or not it's a valuable discussion. And Marie and I are like, full stop. It does not matter what angle you approach this at. There are some distinct truths, which is if women do not have sufficient hormone status as they age, they have a limited health span. Lifespan is going to be long. Health span ain't going to be so great. And that's wrong. I don't care why we got to this place, to be perfectly honest. Marie and I are just like, you guys go fight about all that yourselves. We're going to talk about what can we do about it. And I think that's like Maria hit on, we're educators. That's all we're trying to do is get women to be like, look, you don't need to be gaslit by your doctor anymore. You don't need to be dismissed by your doctor. All of these things, you just need to understand what's going on and then advocate. And women are great advocators. We do it our entire lives for everyone around us. It's difficult sometimes to put that hat on for ourselves. So we're just trying to give women sort of the, you know, teeth that they need to take that bite and run with it.
Yeah. Oh, I already feel myself getting, I'm burning with questions. I'm burning with passion. Kristen and Maria, it's getting intense already in here because I, again, what always appeals to me so much about the work that you're doing is how non-controversial it should be. Huh. And there is not a woman that I have on a discovery call. There's not a client that I have who has not asked me the question before post-menopause. You know, I thought hormone replacement therapy causes cancer. I don't know why I would even take it. Like, there's so much fundamental systemic issues with the work that you're doing. And that's why it's so sticky and why you're getting abused. I hate that you use that word. I hate that that happens online about it. So I want to just, like, let's really lay down the law here. Let's, law for Kristen, who's a lawyer too. Let's lay down the facts here about what is happening in a woman's bodies as we age. And We can also talk about why that gap in knowledge is so vast and probably one of the greatest gaps in knowledge. So much so that, you know, I feel myself educating on a discovery call about this topic. Mm-hmm. Can we just lay down the facts of women's hormones as we age? You can give general time and say what happens, mm-hmm. what the changes are, and roll us through that.
Yeah. Okay. So starting typically in like the late 30s, early 40s, we start to have a decline in our hormones. So that is things like DHEA. We don't talk about that too much, but progesterone does decline and it usually doesn't bounce around much. Okay. So kind of just creates, kind of starting to go downhill. Estrogen will bump around a bit and, you know, we'll get so many women saying, oh, I'm estrogen dominant. Well, you're probably not. You just probably caught your estrogen in a bit of a, you know, a spurt. And then, okay, so that happens for, you know, can be many years, can be 2 years, 4 years, maybe 10 years. Once you go 60 days, though, without menstruation, if you are over the age of 45, like, you are definitely late-stage perimenopause at that point. Okay. So then we get to that menopause, which is that one day. And, you know, we're probably pretty hormone deficient at that point. And then everything else is postmenopause. But like, we try to remove fertility, right? Because so many women see the period as sort of like a marker and a harbinger of fertility. And it's really ovarian senescence. And it can start, you know, years and years and years before, right? And then, you know, then what kind of follows that is a certain degree of immunosenescence with age. So now we're talking like mid-50s, late-50s, early-60s, you know, inflammaging. This is greatly kind of magnified when we are hormone insufficient, which is what we are at some point along that journey if we are not replacing back those hormones.
Yeah, so this piece of the puzzle is really important for people. People believe progesterone and estrogen, if they don't know, are hormones that are just related to fertility. Sure. This is such a huge question, and you do not have to go into, you know, excruciating detail, but can you tell us just briefly some of the other functions of progesterone, some of the other functions of estrogen, and why it's so important for us to have adequate amounts of those hormones at any age?
Yeah, I mean, I think we'd say that if we think of the menstrual cycle as what everyone focuses on, menstrual cycle is just one thing that is happening throughout our monthly cycle. That fluctuation, which for women who don't know, you know, we have a day 12 peak of estradiol, and then we start progesterone production around day 14. That peaks around day 21, get another little bump of estrogen, they both decline. Progesterone stops and we get our period. Okay, it's not just the period that's happening. We are maintaining our bones. We are literally triggering bone remodeling through this rhythmic dance of estradiol and progesterone. We are maintaining our muscle architecture. You know, we all have type 1 and type 2, fast twitch, slow twitch muscles. That changes. You know, as women, you can see a lot of women, they start to go towards like endurance sports as they age. Well, that's because they're losing their fast twitch muscle architecture. When we're younger, our estradiol and progesterone's dance actually maintains that muscle architecture. It maintains the flexibility of our ligaments and tendons. It maintains the cushioning in our bones. It also maintains our vaginal tissues, ladies. It prevents, you know, recurrent UTIs. It makes us get nice and moist when we have intimate encounters. It protects our brain. It is making sure that our arterial endothelium, the walls of our arteries and glycocalyx, maintain intact structures. So it's truly not just our menstrual cycle. It's actually our whole body health. It's maintaining how we process carbohydrates, how much insulin we can release. You know, there's so much that goes into it. And that is the piece that we feel is really an injustice. Girls need to be taught this in middle school, right? If they're, I think they're still teaching about periods in health class. I don't know, but I don't have girls. But that needs to be an element that they need to understand, because I think we're conditioned to see these hormones as almost the antichrist in our body, that our period is a major drag on our life, and that this whole hormonal milieu is really kind of a drawback from our quality of life. And if women and girls started to learn that actually this is our freaking superpower, right? This is what makes us be able to multitask. This is what keeps us calm. This is what keeps our muscles being able to, you know, respond. I mean, Marie and I are older than you, but when we grew up, girls weren't necessarily as competitive athletics at younger years as they are now, right? Well, when you see a girl really come into her own at age 13, 14, 15 and start to become this really cool athlete, that's your hormones, girls. So that sort of stuff is what we wish people understood, because then they would be able to see that when those hormones decline, like Maria described, and they eventually disappear, so does their work behind the scenes. So does the bone remodeling. So does the maintenance of the muscle architecture. So does the maintenance of our arteries. So does, you know, the strength of our heart, our neurotransmitter production, our gut microbiome. Everything changes when we lose those hormones. So why do we want to age without them?
How did this kind of gap in knowledge come to be? So why do you, and this could be a theoretical question, this could be an actual science question, this could be a funding question, when in time did we start to just accept that women are not going to feel well after 50 or whatever that number is for them? Like, when did this gap start to happen? And is the gap also a result of us just living longer? Is that part of the reason why it's only, we're only starting to acknowledge how important this is now? I don't know. Again, very theoretical question, but I'm curious what your take is.
Yeah. I mean, so there's someone who we respect, but who loves to hammer this like theory that women didn't used to live this long. Well, that's just fact. I mean, you look back in census data and whatnot, we didn't live this long. No, why didn't we? Usually because we didn't have antibiotics. We were still out running animals. You know, we were threatened by more acute threats, right? Mm-hmm. So women had a much shorter health span. People can claim that that's not true. It is true. We've got the data to back it up. Our health, our lifespan. Our lifespan started to increase as conventional medicine started to be able to address. People got shelter, people got food, you know, people got antibiotics, etc. So lifespan started to increase, but women's health span did not follow. We stopped dying of childbirth, we stopped dying of pneumonia, but we started dying of other things. And it was actually the early 1900s that menopause was actually deemed a medical condition and that hormone replacement was characterized as preventative medicine for women. Okay.
Cool. What happened? Cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. And if you look way, way back, I mean, the Chinese, God bless them, they were on this with Chinese medicine hundreds of years, not decades, centuries before us, that they would look at a woman who maybe had what we now call PMDD, right? She had severe mood disorders when she'd menstruate. They would start using metabolites out of a woman's urine in order to create hormones and replace them to flatten out her moods. Like, really shocking, cool stuff. But by the 1900s, in terms of the Western civilization, it was accepted by the American Heart Association, the American, you name it, every medical society saw replacing hormones in the early 1900s as preventative medicine. What happened, unfortunately, was the medicalization of those hormones, right? The pharmaceuticalization. Shock, I know. and, you know, we had some pharmaceutical companies decide that they could mass market hormones and that they would do it by using non-human extracts of various things and then synthesize them in a lab. So we started going from giving natural hormones to women to giving them hormones that on a molecular level were not the same as what we normally produce. They were close and they sometimes could do the job, but we didn't appreciate that they were also then causing other changes. And so it was around the 1950s and 60s, they started to see some heart issues. And eventually in the United States, they said, hold up, until you can show that these are not cardio, you know, deteriorating medicines, we cannot have this as the standard of care to prevent chronic disease for women.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah. Okay. So we need a study. We need a study. Now, ironically, we all like to focus on what's called the WHI, the Women's Health Initiative, but there were actually studies that predated that. Unfortunately, they were small or they weren't designed correctly or they just didn't have the right endpoint. So we did have a couple decades where people had mixed results depending on what form of hormones they were using. And then we enter what is very interesting because no one wants to talk about it is, you know, women got emancipated, women got many more rights. And then we have the feminist movement start in the 60s, right? Feminism, it's like burn the bra, women can work, delay childbirth, all this kind of stuff. And ladies, here's a birth control pill, sexual revolution, here we go. So what happened then is the FDA and the US government said, hey, we're going to give a ton of money to anyone who's willing to study women's health issues. And as much as people might know about the WHI, what they don't realize is that the original study architects, they were intending to show that hormones were dangerous. That was their end goal.
And what was that? Why was that their end goal, Kristen?
Because they were paid by the pharmaceutical companies.
I was just curious.
This isn't like tin hat conspiracy. I think we're in an age say this, but it is totally proven. So anyway, they went at it with a study design that would show that this was problematic. Ironically, they really fouled the ball by managing to make an even worse study than they thought they were making using horrible things, you know, women who were already well past menopause, who had changes in their health already, we're not monitored and screened, all of these kind of things. And we all know the WHI comes out and says, oh my God, not only are hormones bad for your heart, they actually cause cancer and they do these other things. And so we must avoid hormones. And so, you know, in the early 2000s, the study was stopped abruptly. Women had their hormones pulled out of their hands. Medical schools said, no more. We're going to now teach HRT is dangerous. Now we've got generations of doctors who believe that. And, you know, sadly, the own study people, authors, have come back and they've walked back their conclusions. And they said, we were wrong. It was the wrong design, wrong hormones, wrong women, all of these sorts of things. And so the conclusion should not be kind of extrapolated out as they have been.
Oh, come
and unfortunately,
on.
That's fallen on deaf ears in many circles. So, yeah.
Wow. So right. it really, much like, you know, I had an episode on cholesterol, which you guys speak about all the time too. And we really walked through the exact layout of which studies led to which conclusions. And we now know, you know, if you review the literature yourself, it's pretty definitive, like that, you know, intake of dietary cholesterol does not cause these things in the same exact way that you feel and know. And sorry, let me not use the word feel, you know, the science points in one direction because the people who designed the studies themselves walked it back. They even themselves said this wasn't true. Is this also related to the breast cancer piece of the puzzle?
Yeah.
That was one of the conclusions from that too.
Yes. You know, we've talked about estradiol or estrogen and progesterone. The hormones that were used were synthetic. One was conjugated from horse urine. It's called CEE. We know it as Premarin now. And then we had a synthetic progesterone. And you would call that a progestogen. Is kind of a bucket term. So women, it's important that they understand kind of what someone's saying when they hear these things, because it definitely sort of unmasks the speaker as to their bias or lack of understanding of things. So a progestogen is the bucket term. Within that, we have progestins, which are synthetic, and then we have progesterone, which is what our natural body makes. And unfortunately, they used a synthetic progestin in this study. And it is well known that progestins, which, girls, is in your birth control pill, are endocrine disruptors. And what that means in terms of women's health and breast cancer risk is that it actually alters the receptor for estradiol in the breast. And so what happens is then when progestins are used in an HRT formulation, even with a natural estrogen, whether the estrogen is safe or not, the progestin disrupts that receptor and can cause proliferative behavior by the estradiol, meaning a lot of tissue growth, DNA.
Especially for estrogen dominant breast cancers, obviously.
Estrogen receptor dominant. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. And so that is part of the issue, is that, you know, we've drawn this global conclusion and we don't bother to say that any progestin is an increased risk of breast cancer. We don't say that. We just say HRT is dangerous. And we had yesterday, Maria and I had someone who said, my mom had estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. And so I will never, ever take estrogen. And yet I thought, well, but have you had a baby? Yes. Well, if you had a baby, your estradiol at some points were like thousands of times higher than it is under your everyday life. And you came out of pregnancy without breast cancer. Estrogen in and of itself is not dangerous, right? We have to have an underlying environment that creates kind of a failure of apoptosis, cellular death, you know, DNA issues, et cetera. And that's usually what comes into play with these progestins. So,
It has to play. It has to be taken in the context of there's no one singular thing that also causes cancer. That's not how it works. But of course, if the environment is proliferative or supports proliferation, then introducing something can be dangerous. But the biggest problem with the kind of that working theory from what you're saying is that it's in a lot of birth controls, and the birth controls, never do you hear a discussion of birth control causing breast cancer. And how quickly do we prescribe birth control? Like how quickly are people getting those prescriptions and staying on it forever? But it's not so like you said, that's the easiest way to kind of poke holes in that fun little argument, is like, if your doctor is so against HRT, are they also against birth controls that contain the exact same, you know, chemical?
No, and that's the question.
They're offering it.
Exactly.
It's actually considered okay for women up to age 55 to use the birth control pill as a means of controlling symptoms as they are transitioning through menopause. The worst advice.
That's like an unbelievable thing to me too, it's that you're stopping natural hormone production in order to promote natural hormone production. Like that feels, that doesn't feel natural or right. So this is the kind of context of which we're understanding again. Let's say people are living to, I know the average lifespan is also decreasing every year, horrible, in the United States, yeah. But let's say people are living to their 70s, 80s, 90s and beyond. From the age of 50, if women do not kind of go on hormone replacement therapy, this is a ridiculous question. Is there a percentage of people you would say who would feel as good without the hormones as they do with the hormones before they went through menopause? Ridiculous question. I understand that, but I'm just speculation.
Maybe there are a few, but here's the thing, Michelle. Couple of thoughts on that. We tend to normalize, right? Negative kind of health, you know, downturns in our life. Like we put up with, you know, pain or headaches or aching shoulders because, you know, I'm
dry vaginas.
Dry vaginas.
I mean, we've been told that's normal, right? You just have less sex when you're older because your vagina's dry. I mean, that's,
yeah.
Yeah. And also the normalization of women's pain is also a bigger part of this conversation too, obviously, and suffering.
Sure. Yeah, so could there be women that feel okay with HRT? I'm going to say yes. But I said one thing is we normalize. The second thing is you can feel okay, but you don't see the degradation of your vascular endothelium or the thickening of your blood vessels, stiffening of your blood vessels. Or, you know,
your bones deteriorating. I mean, we have someone right now who is got all the things. If you looked at him on the surface, right? Lean, active, lifts heavy weights, eats lots of protein, all the things, but has struggled from a hormonal standpoint for a long, long time because of just some bad care and compliance issues and whatnot. And has just been diagnosed osteopenic or osteoporotic, Marie, or which one?
Osteopenia.
Yeah. Osteopenia. Yeah. So that's what Marie and I always try and get to women to say is like, it's kind of irrelevant how you feel.
Yeah,
the statistics are there. You know, we lag men in cardiovascular disease issues until 55. And then we catch up and we match them, if not.
Yep. It's 50% after the age of 55, right? Yeah. Or women.
Yeah. And then, you know, you look at the number of prescriptions that your average 65-year-old woman is on. It's horrifying. Now, tell me that's health. That's not health. And, you know, when a woman will be like, I breezed through it, we're like, okay, A, how old are you? Because the vast majority will say that are like 58, 59, whatever. Talk to me when you're 63. Because Marie and I have had the benefit of literally working with thousands of women. And I tell you, there is like a magic window between 60 and 65. Just like there is between 40 and 45 in that perimenopausal transition, women feel like the rug gets pulled out from underneath them. Everything that they used to do doesn't work. 60 to 65, they go, oh my God, how did I become so health challenged? And it's very tragic because it doesn't have to be that way. If we had the information, if we gave it to women at 40 and we, you know, followed them, monitored them, and made sure that we stayed in front of any hormone depletion, they wouldn't be that statistic that we all know. And that is what's so frustrating.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this, conversation again, when I'm having it with clients, even on a discovery call, and they'll say to me something like, you know, Michelle, do I have to go on hormones? Like, first of all, beginning of the conversation, they're saying, I feel all these symptoms and it really changed for me during menopause, you know, what's going on? And they'll say, do I have to go on hormones? And I'll say, listen, I'm a great dietitian, but I can take you to a point, but at some point you might need some sort of medical intervention. And that is like the reality. And it's not like a harsh medical intervention. We're not talking about like surgery here or something like that, but it's from a functional nutrition perspective. I think people are always saying, are there natural solutions to all these things? But it's like, honestly, evolutionarily, like, no, like, it's like, I can help you feel better symptom wise, obviously, in many ways. But at the core of the issue, we have like a real problem, which is that we are living very long and accepting that we feel really not good during that time. And it's like, I can't, you know, it's a similar conversation with fertility. I have clients who, you know, functional dietitian clients who work with women with fertility, you know, most of them and are friends with most of them. And they will say, like, listen, are there so many things we can do now because of modern medicine that we couldn't do before in ways of like IVF and all these solutions that work for many women that are more targeted, precise, and everything like that? Yes. Is there still an age limit on what our bodies do? Also, yes, there is an age limit. Yeah. And it's like, sorry, there is a hard limit. There's like some facts about biology that are just true, which is that women will reach menopause and they will not have those hormones anymore. And those hormones are really important to health. So that is the tougher conversation I have to have with people, which is like, you know, most of my clients are actually in their 50s and 60s. Like a vast majority of my clients are over the age of 50. But I have a split, half man, half woman. But I do have that conversation where I'm saying, listen, can I help you with your gut issues? Can I help you with all of this? 100%. But I will tell you, there is a factual limit to, you know, feeling that 100%. Most people don't need to feel 100%. But if they wanted to, which a lot of my clients ultimately want to, it's just like there's fact that you have to take into account. And I think I'm glad that you guys are also saying that over time, you're liking these solutions a lot more too. And then I want to talk about that too. Like, tell me what you've been excited about in ways of scientific progress, in ways of the HRT that you, I'm not going to use the word recommend, but that you acknowledge as being more safe or more helpful and healthful. I know you mentioned horse urine as being the component of the initial one. What do you like now? What are you excited about?
Before we get to that, can I just point one thing? In the back of everything that you just said is something that I think women overlook, which is it's not just our hormones. We cannot drink 3 glasses of wine after dinner, stay up late, eat crap food, fast extensively, while working out extensively, you know, all of these things that if women are opposed to hormones, right? If they are saying, Michelle, I don't want to do these or I'm scared of them, then say, okay, but are you willing to do all the other things?
Totally.
Because that's part of, it's, you know, the vast majority of the picture, hormones are just one piece of that puzzle, right? There are a ton of other pieces. So if women have any reluctance or concerns, it's like, well, why don't you then invest your time into deeply, intentionally dialing in every facet of your health? Then you can make the decision, right? Then you'll feel less like there's a gun pointed at your head. But too often women are asking the hormone question with completely putting blinders on to their own contributions to their shitty health. And I'm sorry, you have to wake up and own it. And this is where Maria and I get really bitchy.
And I love that. And I love the word you used. Yeah. I love it. I also will say that, you know, the funny part of that equation is that people do come to me for the personal accountability. They actually want to be more accountable for their health. And that is, like I said, I'm not quantifying, but like jokingly quantifying, let's say speculatively quantifying. Let's say I can take them 60% of the way, 70% of the way. The part that they should be, you know, more apprehensive about is their ability to make those 80% changes, not about taking the medication or something like that. It's funny that that's the thing that's more risky when it's the one that's, they're not accountable for, you know, the piece that they are accountable for and they can take control of, because it's much bigger and grander and harder to accept. And I do, you know, again, most of my clients are above the age of 50. Not all of them are on HRT. Some of them, like we said, feel amazing. But if it's a question of, you know, do we think it's like necessary? No, but could it make you feel a lot better? Yes. Do we think the lifestyle piece is necessary? Yes, it is necessary to feel well. And again, the hormones are helpers for, like you're saying, muscle building, cardiovascular health, all of these things. They are necessary and probably necessary, but not necessary. The reason I'm not using that word is because I know they're not accessible for everyone. So I also want to say, like,
they're necessary, but not essential. Right.
Necessary, but not essential.
Yeah.
Exactly. And
yeah.
There are many of my clients who, again, don't take them and feel well, but I don't know, they wouldn't feel even better, or they wouldn't have better bone health, or they wouldn't have better muscle health, or they wouldn't have better internal health, you know, as a result.
The bottom falls out. This is why we're kind of loud about this in the beginning. There is a window of opportunity in which initiating hormone therapy will provide not just the best outcomes, but have the best situation. And the reason for that is because these things are happening in the background, whether you can feel them or not. So if you wait, let's say, until you're 67, and all of a sudden you go, oh my gosh, I want to start HRT, the reality is you may have some cardiovascular changes in that then make that HRT a limited option for you. Right. So that's the only issue for us, is that to make sure that women understand that there is a window of opportunity. Yes, dialing in your health is essential, because just as when we're in our 30s, if we're, you know, smoking all the time, we're putting ourselves at risk for blood clots, right? And changes. So you don't put hormones in an unhealthy body. So do all the hard work, but know whether or not this is something that's within your reach. Because if it is, there is sort of this limited opportunity. It's not, we have a client who started in her 70s. She's thriving, but she also was someone who went into it lean, always a good eater, not a drinker. You know, she had so much going for her coming into that window. So anyway, that's just the one thing I wanted to point out, because the work that you do is essential to every woman, regardless of where she is on her age thing, because as she ages, the better her metabolic condition is, the less her symptoms are going to be, right? And then the better any hormone choices would be. So anyway, now we can get to kind of, Maria, you want to talk about the types of hormones, obviously, you know, not...
We really prefer transdermal estradiol. There are some women that can do estrogen injections. That can be an option. Not testosterone injections, though, okay? Because we've seen too many labs where women... just the numbers are just way too high. It's not physiologic. It's just not normal. And then progesterone can be cream or can be oral. I would say we both like oral a little bit better, but cream is certainly doable. And I will also say this, progesterone cream can be accessed. It's like you don't need a prescription, at least in the U.S., you really, women shouldn't play around with progesterone cream on their own.
Well, hormones are not a DIY. That's what we always say. HRT is not a DIY, and too many women are doing that.
No, it's a prescriptive medication. I mean, it's let's be serious about this. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Do you, what are the progesterone creams made of now? What are these, the transdermal estradiol too? Tell me.
So they all come from a specific plant compound called diosgenin, and that is in, I believe it is in Mexican wild yam, and I think soy as well. Now,
love it.
You cannot eat yams and get progesterone. Okay. No, it's true. Yeah. I mean,
it's one specific component of it, it's magnified. It's not, you need like how many sweet potatoes? Like millions.
And your body just has to break it down. Yams. They can't be, you know, the sweet potatoes that you're finding in the produce section either. So
now here's a little bit of an interesting thing. If you eat soy, will you get some estrogen? Yes, but we don't recommend that. Generally.
It's the same, and this is actually the same conversation that always comes back with soy and breast cancer too. That was always the conversation because of the estrogenic effects, because of the similar receptor site.
And
so
honestly,
that has always been the conversation.
And here's why it's kind of a little bit of a problem. Some of the, let's kind of throw in flax as well, because that is also a pretty potent phytoestrogen. Again, if you are dead set, I'm not doing HRT, come hell or high water, you know, we can recommend several great supplements. We have a handful that are great that can kind of be a bit of a stand-in, doesn't replace HRT at all. And you can do flax, totally. However, we always like to say, like, if you are doing HRT, don't go crazy with the soy and the flax, because it actually can
it's
be
real.
A bit of an
anti-receptor.
Yeah, exactly.
Anti-estrogen. Which in some aspects might be considered good at certain receptor level in the breast, but it's too much of an unknown. And for women taking HRT, like, you know, it's HRT. That's it. It's not all that other stuff as well. Well,
I like that you're saying that too, because I like that it's for people to know, A, there are some things that can make a modest improvement. And again, no replacement in symptoms, not... If you're having a modest improvement in estrogen or something, it doesn't mean that you're getting the benefits of the hormone itself. And that's important to say. I got your back. I know exactly what you're saying. So again, I don't want people to feel blocked out, because the bigger part of the conversation that I want to get to is that it's lovely for us to have this conversation. If people don't have you both, the likelihood they're going to get the right dose of HRT and that they're going to get to the right doctor is freaking hard. It's hard. It's so low and it's so behind the times. I know you both have created these pathways for people to get directly to where they need and how to learn about their own bodies, to advocate for themselves. That's a lot of the work you do is education and advocacy, and that's the absolute truth. How the heck do people even start this conversation with their gynecologist or with their primary care doctors? Like, how do we start the advocacy on a individual level? If let's be real, they really can't get to like a compounding pharmacy or a doctor or something like that.
Yeah, there are other formulations like the patch, which is technically considered standard of care by various medical societies, is a fine stand-in. You know, it does deliver bioidentical estradiol, which is what we want. You know, that's the one thing I think we'll just kind of side note is that we have various estrogens. There are three main ones, estriol, estradiol, and estrone. Estrone is primarily produced by the fat cells, and it's what we tend to have the most often as we age. Unfortunately, it doesn't act the way we want it to. Estriol is primarily a hormone and estrogen of pregnancy. We're all going to have some, a little bit, but it also is not potent enough to trigger the bones and protect the heart and protect the brain and all these good things. So what we want is estradiol. Important for women to know because unfortunately there are some formulations that combine them or kind of subterfuge, like this is estrogen when it's estriol. So the estradiol patch is available to almost all women. I believe it's Medicare. Everything can get that. Oral Prometrium, it's a branded oral progesterone that's bioidentical. Perfectly fine. So those are available to most people. Even if you don't have insurance, GoodRx has phenomenal coupons. You can go. During the pandemic, I was moving. I couldn't get my Prometrium. I was like, oh, crap. And I literally used my GoodRx and it was like $12. So, you know, there is more accessibility than what women realize. I think, you know, Maria and I have had the unbelievable good fortune to be approached by a book company. We're publishing a book and we're going to try to give women, we're going to give women that A to Z, right? So that they can make that decision as to sort of, you know, what's the whole spectrum of what's available to me. And sadly, it's going to start with, well, nothing, or the birth control pill, or an IUD, or pellets, or something that's very fashionable these days. And then it's going to go into these bioidentical options that are more physiologic and sort of give women that sort of survey of the landscape so that they're able to go and have that conversation with their doctors. Now, OBGYNs admit, this is, again, not me and Maria being conspiracy theorists, 74% of OBGYNs say they never received any training and education on menopause. They don't feel comfortable speaking about menopause to women as they age. So unfortunately, the one person that we've had some pretty intimate moments with in our lifetime as a doctor might not be the best person. Now, some of them are. I moved across the country and went to see someone new, kind of just, you know, threw a dart at it, and she was 100% on board and super supportive and whatever. So they are out there. But we don't want to disparage doctors generally. Just know that they're not necessarily getting the training. But anti-aging doctors tend to be people who are more focused on this. I think some gerontology doctors are starting to come around. Ironically, my cardiologist was someone who was like, please go on hormones for your heart. So, you know, you start to kind of be a sleuth and interview providers around you and see, you know, who has the chops to at least
women sleuth. It's something women do. We sleuth. Yeah. I mean, this is an absolute fact. Also, we were talking about the facts about men. This is a fact. Women know how to sleuth for sure. And I think, you know, what's very painful and disheartening for me is not that doctors won't prescribe medications if they're accessible in other ways, but when someone goes into a doctor's office and says, I'm in pain and I'm uncomfortable, and the result is this thing causes breast cancer. Like, it's some of the most unusable information and invalidating response you can ever get. And that is what I think I want people to leave with this message of, which is you don't try to disprove or fight your doctor. You got to go a different route. Right. I think that's the real other way to say it is that, you know, doctors have belief systems built in. There are, you know, the most amazing doctors who are healers and are like, thank God for modern medicine. It's not even a question. But some doctors, and what I'm hearing is 74% of doctors don't feel they have education on menopause. And certainly what the only thing they're going to know is that HRT potentially is dangerous. That's the only thing they're going to have heard. So you don't have to really prove that to that doctor. And I think every time we hear that, we lose hope. And I think hope is one of the most important factors in all of our health, for us to believe that we deserve to feel well and that we can feel well. So if you are hearing that message, I need you to hear the exact opposite message today, which is that no matter where you are at, you always can move the needle in one way or another. And it might just not be the expected way that you thought you were going to go.
Maria has a favorite quote. Do you want to share that, Maria, about when you're down on?
Oh, doctors are down on what they're not up on.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Except that
tend to be. And again, I that sounds like I'm bashing all doctors. That's really not true.
It's not. Yeah. No. But I think it's the, well, I mean, what that sentence means is ego. That just means that you have an ego problem. Because, you know, it's so, I love the, you know, the Dunning-Kruger effect, which is like the two psychologists who did the study that says, like, it's basically like the audio slave song, the more I see, the less I know. So as basically when you start in your career, you have the highest level of confidence and the lowest level of competence. And then as time goes on, if you are like an awesome practitioner, and like, I will talk to my friends all the time who've been dietitians 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And they're like, do we know anything? I'm like, we don't know anything anymore. You know, that's how, you know, like, I think that's the practitioner I want to go to, who's like, I don't know. Let's find out, you know, that curiosity about things.
Yes.
But, absolutely. If you're going to a practitioner who shoots something down, instantly says, you know, there's no science to support that. It's like, first of all, there's going to be some science to support everything. So that in and of itself is very closed-minded and not helpful. Yeah. We were ranting this morning, all three of us, about this study that came out in the Washington Post. Today, it's September 14th, we're recording. By the time this is released, it'll be a little bit later. But about dietitians, basically, who were receiving money from literally Big Sugar. It's the funniest thing that I can saying that phrase in seriousness, and from other companies to say that aspartame is not actually dangerous to human health. And again, my biggest thing in all of this is, what is the usable and helpful information that you're taking away from an appointment, from an education session? What I take from you both so much is that every single thing you say is hopeful, but also factual. You're not going to say, it's okay, I'm so sorry you don't feel well. It's okay that you don't feel well. Women just don't feel well sometimes. You're like, nope, it's not okay that you don't feel well. And it's your responsibility to take care of it and take care of yourself.
Yeah, we like to use the word agency too. You know, is that women need agency over their health because nobody's coming to save us. You know, that's kind of become a popular phrase lately. But it's true. Nobody's coming to save us. And, you know, we are tending to outlive men. You know,
why? By the way,
men have their own hormonal changes and their own kind of, you know, coming into that hormonal decline and a state of cardiovascular disease and everything else. But, you know, we need to feel as though we can steer the ship in some way. And I think that's unfortunately, if you are in a doctor meeting in which the doctor of any stripe, I don't care if it's an ND, MD, OD, DO, whatever, DC, if they make you feel as though you are not in charge of your health, walk away.
Walk out of that damn office. That's exactly right.
Yeah. And, you know, it happened to both Marie. I mean, she got kind of over-medicalized and treated when she was low in hormones. I got gaslit. I was living in Boston. I love my doctor to this day. She's a wonderful, wonderful woman. She's from India. She believed in Ayurveda. But she worked for Mass General. And
you gotta follow the rules of Mass General if you work for Mass General.
Exactly. And she's flat. I knew something was wrong. And my mom went through menopause early at 32 because of surgery. And so I didn't have a paradigm to help me understand what might be going on. And fun fact, my mom ended up with breast cancer at 40 without any hormones. And
I didn't know that was possible. I thought hormones were the only reason anyone developed breast cancer.
I know. But so when I went to my doctor, I'm like, something is wrong. I mean, we women, we know our bodies. We can gaslight ourselves plenty, but there becomes an inflection point where we know something is not right. And when you seek care for that and you are told nothing is wrong, this is normal, or you're too young, I have harsh four-letter words for that. Like, literally get the heck out of there. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel that way too. And I think what I need people to understand is, even hearing that information after, you know, just think of the hope of someone who's been feeling like crap for 5 years to say, oh my God, this might be what's going on with me. It really has been since menopause. I have not felt well, to wise and well. And to think that they have that hope, and then that hope is squashed by a 1 minute appointment with a doctor, and they don't keep seeking. That is what just devastates me. I hate when people lose hope, because I'm so confident that people can, that women especially in this case can feel better. You both have seen it thousands of times. And certainly, again, it's a trialing process. It's not a perfect science, and everyone's bodies respond differently. And you know that, but to just lay down and accept illness is not something that I'm ever going to do. It's not something either of you are going to do. And it's certainly not something that we want for half of the population, half of their lives. That's certainly not what we want for them. Absolutely.
Yeah, the proposition is long. That's the biggest thing, ladies. It's like, understand what you're choosing, because that's a long life of misery.
And until then, again, I think the lifestyle recommendations you would give people are the same that I would probably give people, like eating, especially for women, eating high quality protein. You know, shout out, of course, to Dr. Gabrielle Lyon, who, you know, says muscle is the organ of longevity. Like, this is so critical. I know both of you believe so much in muscle mass as being helpful, not only for the lifespan, but the health span, more importantly, in fact.
Yeah, the Absolutely. Biochemistry of muscle cannot be ignored. I mean, it's just, you know, this is not about lowering yourself onto a toilet without a grab bar, ladies. This is about, you know, being able to combat an infection in your 70s, right? Like, that is what muscle really comes to help us with. So,
and it's also not about being skinny. I find, you know, I had to go through my own kind of early mid-40s, and something I probably grapple with occasionally now as well. I won't be dishonest, but it's about like looking a certain way, Michelle. I know we didn't even touch on this, but just, you know, as women's bodies are changing, and typically in their 40s, you know, they're just like clinging on to so many things like fasting and excess cardio,
or a number on the scale.
A number on a scale, totally. Killing yourself in the gym, or really just like trying to achieve a certain look. And we try to get women, you know, your values are your values, okay? But we try to get them to look at the bigger picture. Isn't it really about your health? Are you really going to care, you know, at 75, you know, how flat your belly is?
And you know what, Maria, can I add to you saying that? What I learned in my dietetics degree, one of the things I loved, was that after a certain age, it's actually more protective to be in the overweight category than it is to be in the normal weight category. By the way, this was like, since I learned this, like, what, you know, 12 years ago or something like that, I at the time was like, whoa. Because it was like definitely a time where weight loss was, you know, king for sure. Yeah. And I was like, whoa. And I'm assuming now, in reflecting on it, that it has to do with not having lost such severe muscle mass and everything like that over time. But the act of weight loss itself,
more protective for bones. Yeah,
exactly. Bone loss. And yeah, exactly. So for sure, especially if we're talking about midlife women, focusing on those last 5 to 10 pounds might just be, those 5 to 10 pounds might be protective, if anything. Well, so
Chinese medicine calls them money bags.
I love that.
They call it money bags. And we tell that to women all the time. I'm like, I'm not getting rid of my money bags, because, you know, we just had something where, I mean, obviously we all just had the global pandemic, but I had a really strange thing happen in July where I got bit by a bug. Oh. I don't even remember seeing the bug. It wasn't a tick. And I just kind of wiped it off. I felt like a sting or a bite, whatever, let it go. Well, within 24 hours, I had boils all the way down my leg.
Get out of here, Kristen. I didn't know this happened.
It was really bad. And then within about 36 hours, I was systemically ill to the point where I'm like, something is really wrong. So I ended up being on prednisone for a week. They were like, you're having a severe allergic reaction to whatever toxin this bug had. Now it's in your system. Now it's turned bacterial. You could go septic. So I ended up 3-4 weeks, Maria, right, where I was sick. I mean, really sick. And this is where modern medicine, we love you, you know, gave me the steroids, gave me the antibiotics, whatever. And had I been at my leanest point, was 3% body fat and everything else, I would not have fared as well. Because those extra 5 to 10 pounds actually help us modulate our inflammatory response, actually mobilize the cytokines that we need to fight infection. Like, there's so much going into our health that if we focus on aesthetics entirely, we will lose. And that is something that Maria and I are like, the scale should never be your measuring stick. Ever.
Absolutely not. Especially if you are losing weight rapidly from something like that, you want to have reserves. That's why our body holds on to weight in the first place. We have to remember our initial, like, evolutionary biological need, which is that we need to stay alive. And that's a really important component, is body fat. And we also know that lifespan wise, there's a U-shaped curve for, like, the the people who are in the largest bodies and smallest bodies are at great risk. So it's, again, focusing on just that little, if you're a person, Kristen, who's lean already, again, those 5 to 10 pounds might be very protective for you in a situation like this. And I'm so glad you're okay. And I'm so glad that you had your money bags to protect you.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's a really powerful message for women too, who again, who are spending their time chasing in the, you know, second half of their life where they're like, maybe not even working. Like, this is the cool half. Like, this is the fun half. You don't have to raise your babies. Like, this is, you know, even though it's a wonderful experience, I'm sure. But, you know, this is like a part of your life where you want to feel really good and experience everything. And the message is not to focus on those last 5, 10 pounds, even though both of you respect so much how, like, important aesthetics are to people and everything like that. Of course we acknowledge
that. We struggle with it. I mean, we're, you know, Marie and I are both incredibly blessed. We have men who have been in our lives for 35, 40 years, and they still walk past us and pinch our asses at the sink. Right? And we're like, don't pinch my fat, you know, or whatever. Like, or like, oh, leave it alone or whatever. And I was just in Norway. We were in this like sauna floating out in the middle of the Arctic Sea, and I'm in a bathing suit, and I'm like, oh my God, I look horrible. Like, I was just like upset with myself. I was getting my period, whatever. And my husband's like, babe, he's like, I do. And I'm like, okay, really, at the end of the day, what matters is not this image in the mirror, but like, do you have people who love you, whether it's a spouse or not, right? Do you have good relationships? Do you have good health? Do you have community? Do you have all those things? That is what we should be focusing on as we age, because we're starting to learn that's a hell of a lot more impactful than, you know, whether or not we manage to only get 1400 calories today. So
exactly. I also, you know, this is such a, I've never shared this before, I don't think on any platform or with anyone before, but I had this friend who was not a friend anymore. I had a friend who was a trainer in the city, and he was completely unsolicited, said to me, like, you know, Michelle, are you happy with your like diet? And I'm like, yeah, I'm good. Like, he wasn't training me either. He was like a random friend of mine. He's like, are you happy with your diet? And I'm like, yep, I'm great on it. I'm a registered dietitian. I'm a functional dietitian. And I have my own naturopathic doctor who works on my diet with me. And I have my own, you know, training coach. Like, what a weird question. And he was like, I don't think you're eating enough protein because do you like what you see when you look in the mirror? Is what this dude said to me. And I was like, first of all, he doesn't know who he's talking to. I was like, that's cute that you don't, I have no idea who you're talking to. But my response in my head was like, dude, not only like, do you not know who you're talking to, but I lost 100 pounds 10 years ago, right? Like, at the time it was like 10 years ago, and now it's like 15 years ago. But I was like, I lost 100 pounds. My body is not going to look like other people's bodies at this point. And I'm totally cool with that. I like the fact that my body can do what it's done and go through such transformation and end up where it is. I'm never going to look like a person who was a gymnast their whole lives and never carried. It's the same thing with women as they age. Like, it's not going to look the same, but like, I wouldn't change an inch of myself because I'm Michelle Shapiro. Like, right. And not even being Michelle Shapiro is a good or bad thing, but it's just literally who I am. And that is literally the story that I tell. And I believe that our bodies tell the story of our lives. Like, you know, you have sons, like Maria has like a million sons who she has to cook like 85 pounds of meat for every single day. I can't even believe what goes on in that household. You know, like these bodies that have done these like moved mountains.
The other thing too is women, because of the proliferation of social media, we've suddenly developed a universal standard, right? That women are trying to achieve. And there's even times where Maria and I have to remind each other, I mean, we're not short women. I'm 5'8", Maria's 5'7".
I'm 5'9", by the way. Are we so tall? I love
that. We're all fun together. But, you know, Maria's Italian, I'm Scandinavian and German. We're not going to have the same body structure. You know, she is much more fine-boned than I am. I'm a broad, you know, Viking. And what struck me was that we really do kind of forget those things, right? We forget our ethnicity. We forget our background, our genetics. You know, I had a really tall dad and a really short mom, and she was squatty, whatever. Like, all of that is really shaping us more than we want to appreciate. And so constantly trying to put a square peg in a round hole is actually just going to amp up stress, which, newsflash, is going to prevent any weight loss. So we had this funny experience. I was in Norway for the last few weeks, and my husband and I are walking through the streets of Oslo, and they had this really cool iron statue. Oslo is a very cool architectural city. And they had this iron statue, and my husband goes, oh my God, stop. And I said, what? And he's like, just stop. and he takes this picture, and it's this kind of odd. It's this naked woman, and she's holding a man by like his neck, and the man is like this tall, and the woman is just massive. She's like this Amazon. And it was a war memorial. It ended up being this kind of cool conceptual thing. But anyway, my husband takes this picture and he sends it to my boys. Okay. He sends it by text message to my boys with no message. And I'm like, why did you do that? And all of a sudden my boys, all in their 20s, I love them to death, come back and say, oh my God, it's mom.
I can't. That's
and I was like horrified at first because this woman had like moderate, but on the small side boobies, broad shoulders, very straight hips and big thighs. And so it was very obvious. And my sons were like, it's mom. You can tell she's Norwegian. I'm like, okay.
But it was. I love your Viking spirit. Well, I love that. And Viking body. Exactly. Yes,
it was a reminder to me, though. It's like, ladies, be who you are. We are all unique and individual. Stop supplanting that universal image of this lean aesthetic from social media onto your own mere reflection. That is not it. You know, again, go back to, are you happy? Do you have a good, you know, faith background? Do you have community? Do you have your health? You know, do you have great dogs and kids and spouses or partners or friends or whatever? That ultimately, please just value that as you age. You know, this other stuff is kind of gravy. And if it bothers you, that's fine. But you have to play an active role in accepting kind of who you are, what you're bringing into this fifth decade of life, and then, you know, kind of what's within your power and then work with it. But
and really the point of the hormones and the point of all this is only to enjoy those foundational pieces anyway. The point is not to, again, push an aesthetic or anything like that. It should be taking it. The goal is to take you closer to the things that you love. It's all for the same reason, for us to be healthy and happy. That's all for the same reason.
Yeah.
I love that. I don't even want to touch. Yes, I'm putting a pin because that's exactly where I want people to, I want them to take that exact message with them as they leave. I want women to take that exact message as they leave. Kristen and Maria, I can never thank you enough. You know, I throughout different parts of the conversation was getting overly jazzed and you let me go there and I came up and down with you and we all went together on this ride. Where can people find you? Even though I'm sure they're probably following you already because you're like literally, you know, the best and everyone already knows about you, but where can people find you, work with you, learn from you?
So Wise and Well is our Instagram, and then our website is wiseandwell.me.
Easy enough.
In our Instagram bio too, we do have an online free community for women. It's just, you know, Instagram self-limiting and how much we can kind of provide in terms of information and education. So we do have something within something called Mighty Networks, not Facebook, very noise free, et cetera. But it's just kind of a nice space for Maria and I to be offering more long form content to women. So we'd say, if you're interested, go ahead and there, you can ask us questions on the post and whatnot.
Oh, they're interested. They're interested.
We'll have a book coming out in, like, end of 2024.
Yeah, fall of 2024. I think in time for Menopause Awareness Month next October.
I'm going to be running around from different bookstores, like pointing at it, be like, "That's my friend's book. Read it." It's going to be. I'm very, very excited. Thank
you
both.
I'm sure you have many friends that have books.
Yeah, I was going to say you got quite the cachet of friends.
But I love your book the most. Okay, and I mean that.
I have no money to give you, Michelle.
Exactly. Thank you both so much. And I know we'll have further conversations and everything. And I hope everyone will check you out. I don't have to tell them that. They already will. Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Quiet the Diet podcast. If you found any of this information relevant or you related to it, please feel free to share the podcast. It would mean the world to us. Also, remember to subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. And you can follow us on Instagram at Quiet the Diet Pod. We'll put the link in the show notes after each episode. Thank you again for listening. And I can't wait to see you in the next episode.